The Tolkien Road, Episode 244, Morgoth's Ring. Hey there, fellow travelers. Welcome to The Tolkien Road, Episode 244. Greta, what's
hey,
up?
Hey, well, I'm up.
Yeah?
I think this is a record for me, as far as the time goes. Hence the coffee.
It might just be.
But other than that, no, it's a beautiful day outside. We're going to talk some Tolkien, and yeah, life is good.
Boom. I like it.
How about you?
That sounds about right to me.
All right. Cool.
Let's do this thing.
Let's do it.
So on this episode, we are continuing our journey through the History of Middle-earth series as we survey Volume 10, Morgoth's Ring. What do you think about that title?
Mm.
I like that title.
It's a little ominous.
It's very ominous.
But I think it's going to be exciting.
Anything with Morgoth in the title, it'll make the hair on the back of your neck stand up.
Is this Morgoth's Ring? Is this the One Ring?
No. Oh. No, we'll get to where that title comes from here. It's interesting.
Okay.
Before we get started, we'd like to give a shout out to our patrons. Special thanks to this episode's executive producers, Caitlin of Tea with Tolkien, Lise Yu, Andrew T, John R, and Ms. Anonymous.
Thanks, guys.
We also want to give a shout out to our newest patron, Malcolm C. Thank you so much, Malcolm,
yes,
for your pledge of support.
You.
And we want to give a shout out to Caitlin H., who boosted her pledge. So
awesome.
Thank you so much, Caitlin.
Thank you.
You too can become a patron of the Tolkien Road by visiting patreon.com/Tolkien Road. Becoming a patron lets you support the show in a tangible way and lands you some awesome perks like audio recordings of my two books, Tolkien's Requiem and Tolkien's Overture. So check it out now to learn more about all the exciting perks we offer. And don't forget, you can now make an annual pledge and get 1 month free. And then don't forget about iTunes. Subscribe, rate, and review us over on iTunes and other podcasting platforms. Leave us that 5-star rating and help boost our visibility over there for people who are searching for like a new Tolkien podcast to watch. We are currently sitting at 296 ratings with a 4.5-star average rating. So if you are a 5-star Tolkien Road fan, help us get to 300 ratings by the next episode. And let's face it, if you're listening to us this far in, you're probably a 5-star fan, right? If you're listening to us on, this deep into the history of Middle Earth and episode 244, you probably like this podcast. So what are you waiting for, right? Get on over there and leave that rating.
I thought you meant this deep into this episode.
Well,
I was like, John, we just got started.
No. I'm just saying, like, if you are listening, you know,
because
I think
to episode 244.
Because there's no doubt that what most people do is they go back and listen, start at the beginning, right, with the Silmarillion way back on episode one. Whereas some episodes are more like you listen to the more recent episode. On our podcast, people tend to go back to the very beginning and start from there. So,
yeah, I see.
Which makes sense because that's kind of the order we did it in.
Yeah.
All right. It's time for the weekly Tolkien Road Air 5 for all those watching us on YouTube. All right.
I need my left hand.
3, 2, 1. Whoops. All right. So get on over there and get your Air 5. You gotta head over there. That's where we do it. So, we've been doing it for a couple episodes now and, we need as many Air 5s over there as we can get. And then while you're at it, subscribe and click on the notify bell for our channel. Leave us comments, let us know what's on your mind. Have had some good comments here recently over there. So head on over there and, I think we're going to be trying to give more preferential treatment or like front of the line privilege to people who are leaving us a comment over there on YouTube. Because we want to get that YouTube subscriber base boosted, right? We want to get ourselves more visibility on YouTube because we want to do more stuff over on YouTube. We want to do more video, even doing some live streams here in the not too distant future.
I'm excited about that.
Yeah. So help us get our subscribers are at 617 right now. So help us get up to 1,000, right?
On YouTube.
I'm sorry, it was 618. I just checked it. So
slowly
climbing.
Want to climb more quickly.
Want to climb more quickly. So get on over there. All right. So, Greta?
Yeah.
You ready to defeat Morgoth's Ring?
Oh, I don't have the energy right now. But we can try.
Yeah.
We can try.
I actually
talk about defeating him.
I actually said defeat Sauron defeated last week. So I guess I should say something different, right? Something different in there because that was more of a pun. That was kind of supposed to be... Not a pun, but something, just a play on Sauron defeated. But Anyway.
Oh, I see what you're trying to do.
Filling in the blanks. It's a little bit Mad Libs sometimes here when I'm creating the script for an episode.
How about Crush?
Crush, Sauron, Morgoth's Ring.
Yeah, I don't know. What do you think?
I don't know. I think we just need to move on.
Yeah. I don't really know what we're going to talk about, so I'm just going to let you lead this on.
All right.
Music plays a massive role in Tolkien's legendarium, and on his new album Eternal Flame, musical artist Blind Maysee has composed an album 100% derived from the stories of Middle-earth. Eternal Flame is a multi-genre original soundtrack inspired by the profound emotions of The Silmarillion, The Lord of the Rings, and The Hobbit. Ranging from orchestra-themed songs to euphoric piano, Blind Maysee brings his own magical melodies to bear on Tolkien's myths. Check it out now. Just sit back, put your headphones on, and let the music of the Ainur flood your headspace. Eternal Flame by Blind Maysee is now out on all major streaming platforms. Visit blindmaysee.com today to embark on a new Tolkien-inspired musical adventure. Once again, that's blindmaysee.com.
On this episode, we're surveying Morgoth's Ring, which is the 10th volume in the History of Middle-earth series. This volume was published in 1993. After four successive volumes that dealt primarily with the compositional history of The Lord of the Rings, Morgoth's Ring turns its attention to Tolkien's post-Lord of the Rings work on the stories of the First Age. So we are really getting a glimpse into Tolkien's more mature thoughts on the early tales, transfigured through the vast development of the legendarium that took place during the writing of Lord of the Rings. Morgoth's Ring contains five parts. Part 1 focuses on the post-Lord of the Rings development of Ainulindale. Part 2 deals with the continuing development of the Annals of Aman, which is the chronology of events predating the Sun and the Moon. Part 3 is titled The Later Quintus Silmarillion and examines the further development of the narrative predating the Sun and the Moon. Part 4 is Athrabeth Finrod a Andreth. This part looks at a dialogue on the mystery of life and death between the elf Finrod and the woman Andreth. The title is translated The Debate of Finrod and Andreth. And then part 5 is titled Myths Transformed and presents 11 post-Lord of the Rings writings that essentially feature Tolkien pondering and rethinking different aspects of the legendarium. So on past episodes in this series, we'll give a brief overview of each part and look at some highlights, but let's start with Christopher's foreword. So the foreword essentially lays out the answer to one of the major questions of Tolkien's life story, the elder Tolkien's life story. Why wasn't the Silmarillion published in his lifetime? Here's how Christopher explains it. In the years that followed, he was overwhelmed. The demands of his position in the university and the necessity of moving house led him to declare that the preparation of The Lord of the Rings for publication, which should have been a labor of delight, had been transformed into a nightmare. Publication was followed by a huge correspondence of discussion, explanation, and analysis, of which the examples retrieved and published in the volume of his letters provide abundant evidence. It seems not to have been until the end of the 1950s that he turned again seriously to the Silmarillion narrative, for which there was now an insistent demand. But it was too late. As will be seen in the latter part of this book, much had changed since, and as I inclined to think in direct relation to, the publication of The Lord of the Rings and its immediate aftermath. Meditating long on the world that he had brought into being and was now in part unveiled, he had become absorbed in analytic speculation concerning its underlying postulates. Before he could prepare a new and final Silmarillion, he must satisfy the requirements of a coherent theological and metaphysical system, rendered now more complex in its presentation by the supposition of obscure and conflicting elements in its roots and its tradition. So essentially, despite the great demand for its publication, Tolkien's life and own mind stood in the way of the publication of the Silmarillion. The irony of it all seems to be that the very genius that gave us Lord of the Rings prevented the Silmarillion from being fully achieved in his lifetime, and apparently because of said genius. So, you know, to kind of recap what that said, Tolkien, it took him a long time to write Lord of the Rings, as we know, right? Basically from the late 30s until, if you, you know, and just until the publication, all the stuff that goes on past, you know, the first draft of a work of the magnitude of Lord of the Rings, and then all the stuff that has to go into editing it and prepping it for publication. It didn't get published until, I always get the year wrong, but it's, I believe, 1953. So you're talking about roughly a 15, 16 year period in which he's writing this book, and it's kind of his primary focus, in addition to all of his other responsibilities, right?
Yeah.
So he writes Lord of the Rings, and it's transformative for the Legendarium, right? I mean, he fleshes out so much of the future, and then he's like, okay, do I want to go back to the First Age? And just having written two books that are really short compared to Lord of the Rings, it's, you know, once you get to the end of that process, you're exhausted. You're kind of mentally exhausted. And, so I can only imagine how he must have felt at that time. And, you know, did he really want to dive right into the Silmarillion? The other problem is, it's kind of clear that there wasn't yet interest when he published Lord of the Rings and going right to the Silmarillion. So that probably took some of the wind out of his sails. Now, when demand increased and as Lord of the Rings had been out longer, demand for the Silmarillion began to increase. But Tolkien's own mind was like, hey, you've got to figure out how this world really works, right? That's, you know, for a lot of other writers, they wouldn't have been too concerned about that, but that's just who Tolkien was, right? Mm-hmm. It was important to him to figure out the details of, you know, of like the metaphysics of Middle Earth.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And he was a perfectionist too.
Absolutely.
So, you know, he wasn't just gonna, you know, put something on paper and be like, here you go.
Yeah.
You know, like he was gonna make it, he wanted to make it perfect.
Yeah. So that gives us some picture as to why the Silmarillion was never, you know, published in his lifetime. You know, mm-hmm. you'd think that, wow, the Lord of the Rings was so successful, you know, and there was so much demand for the Silmarillion, why couldn't he get it done? And, you know, there's life happens and there's a lot of other stuff that happens, but it's also just him and his own genius kind of stood in the way of it. So,
yeah. And also, you know, and I've never written more than like a, you know, a term paper, really. That's probably the longest thing mm-hmm. I've ever written. But even that is exhausting, and you really need to be free of distraction.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sure you can speak, you know, more to this, but even just little things
mm-hmm.
can just really kind of pull your energy and your focus away, and that just makes it all the more, you know, all the more of a daunting task. So, I mean, he had, what, 4 kids at this time and a wife and was moving. I mean, moving is a pain in the butt. So, man, I can totally understand why
truth.
I didn't get done.
That is the truth. Yeah. Well, and I will say, I think by that point, his kids were essentially full grown. So I don't
know. That's
right.
They would
have been.
Know
that necessary, but there's still family requirements. I will
For
tell
sure.
you, I mean, our oldest is approaching college age, and, you know, our kids are pretty much of the age of being self-sustaining at this point for the most part. But that doesn't make life as a parent really any less busy
or any easier.
Yeah,
no, that's true. It gets harder and more time consuming, but in different ways.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
All right. The title for volume 10, Morgoth's Ring, is explained by Christopher as such. Among the chief structural conceptions of the mythology that he pondered, that J.R.R. Tolkien pondered in those years, were the myth of light, the nature of Aman, the immortality and death of the elves, the mode of their reincarnation, the fall of men and the length of their early history, the origin of the orcs, and above all, the power and significance of Melkor Morgoth, which was enlarged to become the ground and source of the corruption of Arda. For this reason, I have chosen Morgoth's Ring as the title of this book. It derives from a passage in my father's essay, Notes on Motives in the Silmarillion, in which he contrasted the nature of Sauron's power, concentrated in the one ring, with that of Morgoth, enormously greater, but dispersed or disseminated into the very matter of Arda. The whole of Middle-earth was Morgoth's ring. So, in other words, just as Sauron placed so much of his life power and his essence into the one ring, Morgoth placed his life power and essence into Arda itself, into Middle-earth itself, right? So, Arda, the world of Middle-earth, right, was Morgoth's ring, right? So that's why Christopher chose to title this book Morgoth's Ring. Does that make sense to you? Do you see what he's saying there? So you know how we've talked about, like, it's a really interesting concept, but like, why was the One Ring so, like, you know, such a significant thing? And it's because Sauron focused so much of his life, of his like kind of lifeblood, right?
If you will, into its creation.
Into its creation. Yeah. And in a way that's kind of mysterious, you know, and I guess this is something that's worth exploring at some point. He placed part of himself into it, right? A good portion of himself into it, right?
Mm-hmm.
To make it truly powerful.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it's kind of like a talisman to preserve his own,
like
his own power. And when you do create something, it does. Yeah, I was thinking of that from Harry Potter.
I was like,
right?
Do I dare bring in a Harry Potter reference?
No, it's all good. I think that's kind of a good reference for those who have read the Harry Potter series. I don't know if that's exactly how Tolkien would explain it, but when you do create something, like I'm sure Tolkien would identify with this, right? He created the Lord of the Rings, right? There's this analogy. He created the Lord of the Rings, which is a massive undertaking, and his masterpiece, but it took a lot
so much
out of him.
Himself into it.
I mean, it's kind of amazing to think that Tolkien has left so much of himself, of his soul, with us in that book, right?
Mm.
And we think of it with the Silmarils, right? Like Fëanor poured himself into the creation of these Silmarils, and for kind of, that's partly why he was so jealous of them, right?
Yeah.
You know, you think about just that act of creation of a beautiful and great thing, and as soon as you create that too, everybody else wants a piece of it, right? I mean, so everybody else is trying to ascribe their own meaning to this thing that you've created, right? And you're just like, hey, that came from me. Can we start with maybe what I have to say about it, right?
Yeah.
But you know, it's kind of like everybody wants a piece of it, right? Once it's out there, right? Once it's a great and beautiful and recognized thing. I will just say, I mean, even the creation of a podcast like this is kind of a little bit of that going on. And we and that's why I've always tried to be careful about how we, you know, refer to and talk about, you know, talk about this thing, because at root, it's Tolkien's thing, right? Mm-hmm. It's not our thing. So we have to honor and respect what he had to say about it. And, you know, and I don't know, there's a deep and beautiful principle there, but it's also something that, in the case of Sauron, he pours himself into this ring. So his kind of evil purposes are there within the ring. And so Morgoth poured a lot of himself into the creation of all sorts of, or you might even argue the perversion of all sorts of creatures and things of Arda. And that caused his lifeblood and his power, even though he was the greatest of all created beings, it caused him to be dispersed into the world itself. So it was kind of, Arda became his ring. You can kind of think about all of the evil things that exist, from orcs to trolls to Balrogs, and all these things is being some part of that Morgoth's ring, right?
I see. Okay, so this is maybe a way that he's connecting the legendarium of Lord of the Rings to the Silmarillion, to the History of Middle-earth series.
Yeah.
Like, it's just a way of connecting, of drawing on something that the readers would have already been familiar with, the One Ring, right?
Yep.
And then making that analogy to what Morgoth, like how Middle-earth became his before his ring.
You got it. Yep.
Okay. Okay.
Yep.
Cool.
Spot on.
Very interesting.
So thematically, this volume deals with post Lord of the Rings writings that focus on what we would think is the first half of the Silmarillion as published. All right. So this is going to, we think of like the first 10 chapters roughly of the Silmarillion and Idalindale and Valaquenta, is like the first half of the Silmarillion. And then it mostly takes place like kind of concerning the Valar and the things of the Valar. And then the last half is more focused on the Noldor and their doings in Beleriand, right? So this volume focuses on the later development, like the post-Lord of the Rings development of the Legendarium with respect to the first half of the Silmarillion, right?
Yeah.
So that's, even though Tolkien was working on a lot of these things simultaneously over the last couple of decades of his life, that's the kind of arbitrary division that Christopher chose for this. And then volume 11 will deal with that second half of the Silmarillion, right? And some other things as well.
And this is volume 10?
This is volume 10, right?
Okay.
Yeah. So, cool cover
right
there.
It is a cool cover.
Got Melkor and Ungoliant destroying the two trees right there.
Ooh.
Jerks.
Let me see Ungoliant.
She's nasty. Right there.
Oh, it's a real close-up.
Right in your face.
I was going to say, that's quite a... Okay.
Yeah.
I was looking at... Yep. Okay. That was an extreme close-up.
Ugh.
Yeah.
All right. Okay. No, do not want extreme close-up of Ungoliant. All right.
Thank you.
Okay. Let's look at the various parts. Part one is entitled Einolindele. According to Christopher, the work of his father, chronicled here, actually dates to a period where he was still composing Lord of the Rings, probably in the late 40s. You'll recall that Tolkien had written an early version of Einolindele in the 1930s, and this version essentially picks up as a revision of that work. And so it's kind of interesting to think about, like, as we've gone through this History of Middle-earth series, we can trace the development of stories. And the music of the Ainur really goes all the way back to early on, right, to the beginning, but it developed over time into a into kind of a standalone narrative. I'm very sorry about clearing my throat. It's earlier than we usually record, so I've got kind of that, you know, early morning frog in my throat.
Yeah.
So I'll try to turn away when I need to clear my throat from now on, so it won't gross you guys out or anything. So Tolkien had written an early version of this, of Einolindele, that's starting to get somewhat similar to what we're used to in the 1930s, before Lord of the Rings, and so now he's coming back to it. One of the most striking things we discover here is that Tolkien was in fact wrestling with two versions of this work, one in which Arda is flat and one in which it is round. The round world version also varies from the final version in that it is the sun, in that the sun actually exists from the very beginning of Arda. Right? So, you know, we know from the Silmarillion that the sun and the moon are placed in the sky after the darkening of Valinor because to give light to the world, right? And it's basically, they come from two fruits, right, of the two trees of Valinor, right? But in this version, in an alternate version, the sun actually exists from the very beginning, right? It's put there at the very beginning of Arda. So that's one difference, that and being the round world. We also learn much of the development of Melkor's role, as well as the continuing use of a frame narrative late into the legend's development. For example, here's a passage from Manuscript D, one of the latest. But Manwë was the brother of Melkor, and he was the chief instrument of the second theme that Ilúvatar had raised up against the discord of Melkor. And he called into himself others of his brethren and many spirits, both greater and less, and he said to them, "Let us go to the halls of Anar, where the sun of the little world is kindled, and watch that Melkor bring it not all to ruin." And they went thither, Manwë and Olmo and Ale, and others of whom thou shalt yet hear, Elfwine, and behold, Melkor was before them. But he had little company, save a few of those lesser spirits that had attuned their music to his. And he walked alone, and the earth was in flames. The coming of the Valar was not indeed welcome to Melkor, for he desired not friends but servants, and he said, "This is my kingdom, which I have named unto myself." But the Valar answered that this he could not lawfully do, for in making and governance they had all their part. And there was strife between the Valar and Melkor. And for a time Melkor departed and withdrew beyond the arrows of the sun, and brooded on his desire. So that little reference there to Elfwine, right, is part of that the frame narrative that we find here. You might recall from previous discussions that that Tolkien was basically trying to work this into a mythology of England, and so Elfwine had basically heard this story from a, you know, someone who knew it, right, is an ancient source for the creation of the world. But I call that out because I find it very interesting that Tolkien was still wrestling at this point with having a frame narrative for this story, right? Mm-hmm. And again, that just makes me think, like, why didn't we go with the frame narrative? There's a couple of things that begin to stand out to me with even in these later writings that I can see why Christopher, after looking back on it, was a little bit disappointed with the way the Silmarillion turned out. And I wonder if just some, you know, there's just certain things that would have made it so much easier and so much relatable for the average Tolkien fan, the average person that's jumping from, that's making the progression from The Hobbit to The Lord of the Rings, loving The Lord of the Rings, and then being like, I want to know what happened, all the rest of Middle-earth's history, right? And they want to jump to the Silmarillion, but then they get bogged down because they're just like, I don't know how to relate to this. It doesn't relate in any way that I can tell right now to what I read in Lord of the Rings. We also get a glimpse into the mind of Ilúvatar in this chapter concerning men and elves.
Hmm.
But out beyond the world in the timeless halls after the departure of the Valar there was silence, and Ilúvatar sat in thought, and the holy ones that stood nigh moved not. Then Ilúvatar spoke, and he said, "Verily, I love the world, and am glad that it is. And my thought is bent to that place where are the mansions of the elves and of men. Behold, the Eldar shall be the fairest of earthly creatures, and they shall have and shall conceive more beauty than all other offspring of my thought, and they shall have the greater bliss in the world. But to men I will give a new gift." So we get more kind of the mind of Ilúvatar in some of these things. But the bottom line is this chapter is packed with interesting material of a metaphysical nature. I could see us doing a series on the history of Ainulindale for sure, like kind of tracing the development from the very beginning, and you're just focusing on the chapters that deal with Ainulindale itself. It's such a fascinating thing as a creation, as a creation myth. So, yeah. And how it was developing in Tolkien's own mind, and also kind of the deleted scenes, what was left out, in later works. But we're starting to see that Tolkien is really, he's moving beyond just like composing these myths, but he's starting to get into like, okay, how does all this actually work, right? What's actually going on? What are the reasons for these things? So, me personally, I really like that stuff, right? So it's kind of cool.
It is cool, especially considering it's where everything else stemmed from, you know? I mean, it's really where it all started.
Yep.
So, yeah.
All right. Part two is the Annals of Aman. This section has its roots in the Annals of Valinor, which date from before Lord of the Rings, and though based heavily in that work, they represent a fresh new draft. The word annal refers to a record of events, and so think of this like Appendix B of Lord of the Rings, a list of years with important events taking place in that year. Okay, so we're getting the year-by-year kind of layout of what's happening in the Silmarillion with this.
It's a timeline, basically?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Christopher estimates this text to date to 1958. One very interesting detail that stands out here is that Tolkien drastically adjusted the length of a Valian age. Or of the Valian age, let me say that. He didn't actually adjust the length of what a Valian year is, but he adjusted the length of the Valian age. As you'll recall from our earlier episodes, the Annals of Valinor report a span of 30,000 years reckoned according to the sun, equating to 3,000 Valian years for the Valian age. So for all of history up until the darkening of Valinor, right? And actually, I think they say the hiding of Valinor, which is shortly thereafter. So all of those first 10 chapters, roughly, of the Silmarillion, originally Tolkien thought, okay, this is going to take place over a period of 30,000 years, as we would reckon them, or roughly 3,000 Valian years. Here, Tolkien divides the annals into two distinct ages, the first being the years before the blooming of the two trees, taking place over 3,000 Valian years itself, or about 30,000 of our years, and the age of the trees, taking place over 1,500 Valian years, or 15,000 of our years. So the era before the hiding of Valinor is expanded from 30,000 to 45,000 years of the sun. So that's a long time of bliss, you know?
The more time of bliss, the better.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's not all bliss. There's some bad stuff that happens in there, but you know, we're accustomed to thinking of like, whoa, 3,000 years for the second age and the third age being so like such long periods of time. And they are long periods of time, but apparently everything that happens before, in the early first half of the Silmarillion takes place over, somewhere between 30,000 and 45,000 years. So,
okay.
So there's some interesting, very interesting stuff in this chapter. There's actually a lot of notes of just kind of like doing the reckoning of like doing the math on how long this period actually was in Tolkien's mind. And I will say this is a chapter that I really wish Christopher would have adapted for the final version of the Silmarillion. I think it would have been so helpful just to have a timetable of events, like an appendix that just listed out a timetable of at least of the Silmarillion itself. Mm. If not, you got the second age and the third age, you got those as the appendices for the Lord of the Rings.
Right.
Man, why couldn't you have given us a timetable for the Silmarillion itself, for all of those events? It would have been so helpful, I think, for a lot of people just to be able to lay it out in that fashion.
Yeah, I agree.
So I don't know, maybe that's notes for the revision, notes for the revision of the Silmarillion that will probably never happen. Include an appendix that has a timetable for the Silmarillion in it. based on all of Tolkien's, you know, Tolkien's notes. I think it makes sense. And also the frame narrative, you know, give us a frame narrative. Tolkien thought it was a good idea, you know, maybe not elf wine because that'll just confuse people more, but maybe, like we said, looking back on the, you know, this is, these are the notes of those, of our third age heroes who made the journey to Valinor at the end of Lord of the Rings. So maybe these are the things they learned, right? All right. Part three is the later Quintus Silmarillion. While this covers similar matters of the Annals of Aman, the style is that of a narrative chronicle. So part two is the timetable, right? It's chronology of events. Part three is more like trying to tell the history of the Silmarillion as an actual narrative, right? But like a cohesive narrative. He had again done this at the same, kind of the same fashion when he did the early Annals of Valinor, right? Back before the writing of the Lord of the Rings, he had done something similar with the Quintus Silmarillion. But this is his later version of it. This is his continuing revision of it post Lord of the Rings. Christopher explains, finally, my father turned to a new narrative written in the matter of the First Age before the hiding of Valinor. The first chapter of the Valar, which altered at this time, much altered at this time, became separated off from the Quintus Silmarillion proper under the title Valaquenta, while the sixth chapter of the Silmarils and the Darkening of Valinor, and a part of the seventh of the Flight of the Noldor, were very greatly enlarged and gave rise to new chapters with these titles, of Finwë and Meriel, of Fëanor and the Unchaining of Melkor, of the Silmarils and the Unrest of the Noldor, of the Darkening of Valinor, of the Rape of the Silmarils, of the Thieves' Quarrel. This new work exemplifies the remolding to which my father looked forward in the letter to Rainer Unwin cited above. It represents, together with much other writing of a predominant speculative nature, a second phase in his later work on the Silmarillion. The first phase included the new version of the Lay of Lithien, the later Ainulindale, the Annals of Aman and the Grey Annals, the later Tale of Tuor, and the first wave of revision of the Quintus Silmarillion, much of the work left unfinished. The years 1953 to 55 saw the preparation and publication of The Lord of the Rings, and there seems reason to think that it is a good while yet before he turned again to the Silmarillion, or at least to its earlier chapters. In these substantially rewritten chapters of the second phase, he was moving strongly into a new conception of the work, a new and much fuller mode of narrative, envisaging, as it appears, a thoroughgoing re-expansion from the still fairly condensed form, despite a good deal of enlargement in the 1951 revision. They went back through Quintus Silmarillion and, I believe, Quinta to the Sketch of Mythology of 1926, which had made a brief summary from the amplitude of the Book of Lost Tales. So, he's continuing forward, what we see here is, you know, really starting to get deeper into some of the meta questions, right? A big highlight from this section is part three, is the section entitled Laws and Customs Among the Eldar. This is fascinating, all right? This section itself is divided into five sections of writings. The first deals with the marriage customs of the Eldar. The second deals with their naming conventions. The third deals with death among the Eldar. The fourth deals with the question of rebirth and other dooms of those that go to Mondos. And the fifth deals with the severance of marriage. All right. So, I mean, you're getting into some details about, you know, elfdom, right? Mm-hmm. And how life among the elves was really like. This stuff will start, you know, this is the kind of stuff that I could really nerd out on. But here's a taste from the first section on marriage customs.
I gave you a little taste of what it would have been like to be an elf.
That's right. That's cool. Yeah, a good bit, actually. The Eldar wedded for the most part in their youth and soon after their 50th year. They had few children, but these were very dear to them. Their families or houses were held together by love and a deep feeling for kinship in mind and body, and the children needed little governing or teaching. There were seldom more than four children in any house, and the number grew less as ages passed. But even in days of old, while the Eldar were still few and eager to increase their kind, Fëanor was renowned as the father of seven sons, and the histories recorded none that surpassed him. So seven was like the max, right? Fëanor's seven sons was like the max. The Eldor wedded only once in life, and for love, or at the least by free will upon either part. Even when in after days, as the histories reveal, many of the Eldar in Middle-earth became corrupted, and their hearts darkened by the shadow that lies upon Arda, seldom is any tale told of deeds of lust among them. Marriage, save for rare ill chances or strange fates, was the natural course of life for all the Eldar. It took place in this way. Those who would afterwards become wedded might choose one another early in youth, even as children, and indeed this happened often in days of peace. But unless they desired soon to be married and were of fitting age, the betrothal awaited the judgment of the parents of either party. So, and there's a lot more of just on marriage right here, right? So, you know, we can just think about the interesting phenomenon of, you know, normally they only married once, right? So if one of these elf spouses died, you know, they didn't remarry normally, right? So that, first of all, that might explain to us why Elrond, arguably the most eligible bachelor in all of in all of Middle Earth, never remarried after the death of his, or it was that she didn't die. I can't remember.
Yeah,
exactly.
I know. I was wondering what happened to his.
I know she was she was like injured severely by orcs, and I think she did die. But anyway, that's so bad aside. I should have had my facts looked up there. But anyway, that might clue us into, if she is dead, why he didn't remarry. Mm. It's also interesting to note that with Feanor, who's kind of the most notorious of elves for bad behavior, he is the son of the first wife of Finwë, the High King of the Noldor, right? And then Finwë remarries right after the death of his wife, who was the mother of Feanor, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And then Fingolfin and Finarfin, I believe, are the two, three? It's been a while. Fingolfin and Finarfin, I believe, are the two children of the second marriage. And so that's where kind of the rivalry between Feanor and these others come from. Anyway, it's interesting to note that deviation, given that elves were normally only married once. Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. So,
and the trouble that causes.
Right. Yeah. So again, there's a lot in this section. That's just a little snippet from the marriage customs of the Eldar. There's several more pages on just that topic. And then it gets into the naming conventions, death among the Eldar, their various dooms, including the possibility of rebirth or reincarnation, and the fifth dealing with the severance of marriage. So this is a section, this is one of those definitely flagging and want to come back to at some point.
Could I just, there was one thing that kind of stuck out to me here. It says the Eldar wedded only once in life and for love, or at the least by free will upon either part. Does that mean that only one of them had to have the free will of wanting to marry? Because it says of either part, and I was like,
I can't imagine that means that only one of them has to like want to marry.
That was funny. It was like a funny mental picture. It was like, well, dude, yeah. I have free will. Well, I don't. Well, that doesn't matter. At least I'm marrying you.
Yeah,
will.
I think there's a. I think it means, for both parts.
For both
right?
parts. Okay.
But maybe I'm misreading that. Not sure.
I don't know.
If anybody wants to comment, feel free.
I don't know. It just kind of struck me as kind of interesting.
Yeah.
Or maybe a little bit funny. But I like the way all that sounds, especially about the children not needing a whole lot of. What did it say? Governing or teaching?
Yeah.
It'd be nice to have children that didn't need a whole lot of governing or teaching.
For sure, yeah. Well, too bad children can't be elves.
Oh, well.
Yeah.
Oh, well.
All right. Life as men is so much more difficult than
so
it would be as elves.
Much more difficult.
I mean, man.
Well, oh, well.
Grass is always greener on the other
side.
It
is, but then also we men have the gift of mortality,
yeah.
Which the elves didn't, so, you know.
But as a man, you're just always like, how is that a gift?
Right.
Explain, please.
Right. Yeah.
I could live for ever and like be a cool elf, or I can be a man and live for like 80 years and like the last 40, I'm like just declining.
Okay. Way to get depressing. But it's interesting in this part, it said that, that they mostly married in their youth and soon after their 50th year. So their 50th year was considered their youth. That's crazy.
Yeah.
That's
crazy.
That does sound, that sounds fantastic, actually.
Yeah,
I know. Still be considered young at 50.
Still trying to, hey, Iluvatar, still trying to figure out how that's our gift. Just saying.
I think we've talked about that on a previous episode, so you can just rewind.
It's a huge question.
It is. It's very,
it's a fascinating question.
It's very meta.
Yeah.
Yeah.
For sure.
Mm-hmm.
Part four is Athrabeth Finrod a Andreth, or the debate of Finrod and Andreth. Of this part, Christopher says...
He says what?
While this very remarkable and hitherto unknown work, the debate of Finrod and Andreth, is set at a later time in the history of the elder days than is otherwise reached in this book, it should clearly be given here on account of its association, both in date and contents, with the writings and revisions of the second phase of the post-Lord of the Rings history of the Silmarillion. I have thought it best to let it stand as a separate part in this book rather than include it with the miscellaneous writings in Part 5, since unlike those, it is a major and unfinished work, and is referred to elsewhere as if it had, for my father, some authority. Hmm. So it's kind of out of place thematically for this book because we're supposed to be focused on the Valian years, if you will, the Valian age. And this takes place in Beleriand in a dialogue when men have come into the picture between Finrod, of course, and someone I'll identify in just a second. But Christopher just felt like it belonged more properly to this book for those reasons. This is essentially a debate on what happens to the souls of men upon their death. Finrod is known to us, of course, Finrod Felagund, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And Andreth is a paternal aunt of Barahir, father of Beren, right? So mm-hmm. if you'll recall, Barahir, I think it's Barahir saved the life of Finrod at one point, and that's how Finrod, he becomes a part of the story of like Beren and Lúthien, the legend of Beren and Lúthien, right? And he's one of the great heroes of the First Age. So this is a dialogue between Finrod and the paternal aunt of Barahir. So it would have been like the great aunt of Beren, right?
Hmm.
And so here's a couple of tastes of this dialogue. It's pretty long. There's a good bit in this. All right.
So it's mostly a discussion. Like there's not really a plot.
Yeah, I wouldn't say there's much of a plot. Okay. It's more just kind of a discussion, right? Okay. Very meta, again.
Okay.
Now, the Eldar learned that according to the lore of the Edain, men believe that their Hror were not by right nature short-lived, but had been made so by the malice of Melkor. It was not clear to the Eldar whether men meant by the general marring of Arda, which they themselves held to be the cause of the wanting of their own Hror, or by some special malice against men as men that were achieved in the Dark Ages before the Edain and the Eldar met in Beleriand, or by both. But to the Eldar it seemed that if the mortality of men had come by special malice, the nature of men had been grievously changed from the first design of Eru. And this was a matter of wonder and dread to them, for if it were indeed so, then the power of Melkor must be, or have been in the beginning, far greater than even the Eldar had understood. Whereas the original nature of men must have been strange indeed, and unlike that of any others of the dwellers in Arda. Concerning these things, it is recorded in the ancient lore of the Eldar that once Finrod Felagund and Andreth, the wise woman, conversed in Beleriand long ago. This tale, which the Eldar called Athrabeth Finrod a Andreth, is here given in one of the forms that have been preserved. Just jumping forward into the dialogue. Now it chanced that on a time of spring Finrod was for a while a guest in the house of Belemir, and he fell to talking with Andreth the wise woman concerning men and their fates. For at that time Boron, lord of the folk of Beor, had but lately died soon after Yule, and Finrod was grieved. "Sad to me, Andreth," he said, "is the swift passing of your people, for now Boron, your father's father, is gone. And though he was old, you say, as age goes among men, yet I had known him too briefly. Little while indeed it seems to me since I first saw Beor in the east of this land, yet now he is gone, and his son's son also. More than 100 years it is now," said Andreth, "since we came over the mountains, and Beor and Baron and Boron each lived beyond his 90th year. Our passing was swifter before we found this land." "Then are you content here?" said Finrod. "Content," said Andreth. "No heart of man is content. All passing and dying is a grief to it. But if the withering is less soon than that is some amendment, a little lifting of the shadow." Let me say that again. "But if the withering is less soon, then that is some amendment, a little lifting of the shadow." "What mean you by that?" said Finrod. "Surely you know well," said Andreth. "The darkness that is now confined to the north but once," and here she paused and her eyes darkled, as if her mind were gone back into black years best forgot. but once lay upon all Middle-earth, while ye dwelt in your bliss. All right, so a lot more beyond that. What we were just talking about, right, in part three, right, the whole conundrum of, you know, how is our short-lived life, mortality, a good thing for men? And that's kind of what they're exploring in this dialogue. So this is one I really want to do sooner rather than later, spend some time with sooner rather than later, because I think, I think Tolkien himself was just trying to get to the heart. He was trying to get to the heart of why he wrote these things, right? Like why he had spent so much of his life writing these things. And you know, you can kind of look at them like he's trying to deal with like the deepest questions of humanity, right? Of existence, right? You know, Lord of the Rings, Silmarillion, all these things are, I mean, they're deeply philosophical works. You know, they are contemplations, right, of our reality. So, this one just seems so interesting to me. The Hror, I believe, is the word for the body. I believe the Fea is the soul, and the Hror is the body. If let me double check this here in the appendix, in the index. What is it not doing in the index? All right, it's one of those things. I'm like, duh, should have written that down to be sure. But I believe that the Hror is referencing the body. So why is the body not, not long lived? Let me just look it up here. Hror, there we go. Elder Scrolls. Wait, these are all like other things. Oh, come on. Let's see, Hror, Tolkien.
There you go.
Fea, that's right. Fea and Hror. Fea are the Quenya terms for soul. So Fea is for soul or spirit, and Hroa is body, right? So there you go.
Okay, so you were right.
Mm-hmm.
Good job.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
All right. So this is one, like I said, we'll definitely be looking at in the not-too-distant future. And then part five is entitled Myths Transformed, and essentially contains 11 incomplete writings that are similar in genre to what we saw with the laws and customs among the Eldar. So these are metaphysical writings that feature Tolkien wrestling, even thinking out loud about topics such as the origin of the sun and moon, Morgoth's transformation over time, how Morgoth and Sauron differ, the nature of the Valar, the origin of orcs, the nature of life in Aman, and the reason men were banned from Aman. So really, again, interesting meta topics. These are maybe less formed than what we got in with the debate of Fenrod and Ondreth, but still very interesting nonetheless. It's fun to kind of get this glimpse into Tolkien's mind, as he's unedited mind, I guess you could say. Section 7 actually features Tolkien wrestling with the question of the greatest villain in the history of Middle-earth.
What?
Yeah, so this whole question that we were all arguing about a couple of months ago because... Yeah. Of Lotron Prime and them calling Sauron the greatest villain in the history of Middle-earth. It's interesting. Tolkien actually kind of wrestled with this. So here's a taste of what he says. Sauron was greater, effectively, in the Second Age than Morgoth at the end of the First. Why? Because though he was far smaller by natural stature, he had not yet fallen so low. Eventually, he also squandered his power of being in the endeavor to gain control of others. But he was not obliged to expend so much of himself. To gain domination over Arda, Morgoth had let most of his being pass into the physical constituents of the earth. Hence, all things that were born in earth and lived on and by it, beasts or plants or incarnate spirits, were liable to be stained. Morgoth, at the time of the War of the Jewels, had become permanently incarnate. For this reason, he was afraid and waged the war almost entirely by means of devices, or of subordinates and dominated creatures. Sauron, however, inherited the corruption of Arda and only spent his much more limited power on the rings, for it was the creatures of Earth and their minds and wills that he desired to dominate. In this way, Sauron was also wiser than Melkor and Morgoth. Sauron was not a beginner of discord, and he probably knew more of the music than did Melkor, whose mind had always been filled with his own plans and devices and gave little attention to other things. The time of Melkor's greatest power, therefore, was in the physical beginnings of the world, a vast demiurgic lust for power and the achievement of his own will and designs on a great scale. And later, after things had become more stable, Melkor was more interested in and capable of dealing with a volcanic eruption, for example, than with, say, a tree. It is indeed probable that he was simply unaware of the minor or more delicate productions of Vyavana, such as small flowers. And there's more to it than that, but isn't that fascinating, right? Tolkien, it turns out it's a little bit more complex than maybe we were all thinking about. So
so many different things to consider.
Right, right. Yeah. And yeah, I just love how I just love Tolkien's kind of discussion of this issue right here, right? Yes, Melkor is the, and just in terms of like his beginning, was the greatest of all creatures. But there's an argument to be made that Sauron was actually greater in his maybe effect or employment, right? Or just his like actual villainous employment, right?
Right, in the trail of carnage that he left behind.
Right.
Yeah.
It's like Melkor was kind of the force of nature, but Sauron was maybe better at harnessing, you know, the force of nature
and
right?
wreaking havoc.
Yeah. So
interesting.
Yeah, very interesting. All right. Yeah. So there you have it. I think Volume 10 is my favorite of the History of Middle Earth series by far so far.
Okay.
I love how Tolkien is diving into all these meta questions now that the Legendarium is reaching a stage of maturity. I see us coming back to this volume a lot in the future.
All right.
Sound good?
Sounds great.
All right.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. Well, let's look at some correspondence.
Let's do it.
All right. So first off, we need to... I want to apologize to one of our longtime listeners and one who's been a great correspondent. So this is for Jonathan R., who has sent us a good bit of correspondence in the past and sent us two really good notes back in late January. Very long notes. All right. And so the challenge for me was there was a period in which we kind of got a ton of correspondence all at once. And I was struggling, like, how do I deal with all of this at once? And so I was trying to kind of get to the shorter stuff. And then, you know, Jonathan wrote these two really long, thoughtful notes. You might recall that Jonathan is, as I believe, an ornithologist. So he's a bird expert,
yeah.
Right? So he's corresponded with us a lot about birds over the years. And so he wrote an amazing note on birds in Middle Earth. And it's really long. And I'm kind of thinking, Jonathan, that I want to actually talk to you about maybe coming on the show or at least doing an episode just on that note itself, right?
That would be cool.
You know, here in the not too distant future. But he also wrote another, so I'm going to put that one aside for now because I feel like it really is deserving of a lot of attention. But I want to look at least the other note he sent on that day because it's kind of a follow-up and a final word on this, you know, remember Project Northmoor, right? The whole thing about trying to buy Tolkien's Northmoor house in Oxford and turn it into kind of what exactly were they trying to turn it into? That's kind of the controversial question. So it turns out that they didn't raise the money they needed to get the first phase, but they still kind of got some plans going. Let me read what they say on their website right now, just to give them a fair shake. They're kind of rebranding themselves the Oxford Center for Fantasy. You can help create the first literary center in the world dedicated to Professor Tolkien. They say, we didn't succeed this time to buy Tolkien's old house, but we are continuing the vision by establishing the Oxford Center for Fantasy, dedicated to Oxford's most famous fantasy writer, J.R.R. Tolkien, in an alternative location in the city. The quest goes on, and we are all really excited to share what we are doing. Oxford has inspired many generations of fantasy writers, from Lewis Carroll, the grandfather of fantasy, with his Alice in Wonderland, who vies with Tolkien for the crown of most famous, to fellow inkling C.S. Lewis, author of the Narnia series, to modern-day writers. Our aim is to spread the Oxford inspiration to those wanting to be the next generation of fantasy creators. So, cool stuff. There's a lot more on their website that you can go and look, and you can kind of see what Project Northmoor is up to now. At the time, back then, we were still thinking, like, okay, what do we... you know, what do we all think about what they're trying to do? Because there was controversy. The Tolkien Society didn't like necessarily condemn it, but they were like kind of like they definitely distanced themselves from it. And so Jonathan wrote a thoughtful email sharing his own thoughts on that, and I wanted to go ahead and read that. So this is from January 29th. So this is kind of before the final, you know, most recent updates. So take that in mind as I read this note from Jonathan. Hello, Carswells. I am at the moment drafting a beefcake email on swans and Tolkien's Legendarium and greater mythological structure, as well as answering Marilyn's questions on black swans and crows. Ironically, I was already working on writing about swans before she asked. How perfect.
Oh man.
So
that's awesome.
Yeah, for sure. You know, I probably need to, I should forward his note to Marilyn. So got to remember that. All right. Okay. So I recently listened to the episode discussing the controversy around Project Northmoor. I haven't done a ton of research and due diligence on my own, which I intended to yet do. In the meantime, as an employee of a museum that owns a nature reserve with a conservation easement on the land, I thought I could weigh in here to some degree. So you both brought up many important notes on why the Tolkien Society passed on this opportunity, and a big one was due to the rhetoric from Project Northmoor to save the property. If the building is on a government registry of historical buildings, then it cannot be demolished or altered without great effort and exception. At least that's how it works in the States. The Carnegie Museum, where I work, owns a few homes that are situated in a similar manner and are utilized as a sort of museum all their own. This property, though, is not zoned or situated to effectively be run as a museum for anyone to just stroll up and visit. The land that it sits on, if on proper conservation easement, prevents any construction on the land or destruction of any structures currently existing on said property. Again, this is how it mostly works here in the States and may be different across the pond. It does not surprise me, though, that Tolkien's land would be conserved, preserved, to remain as it was when he lived there. This is a second tier of protection that is currently in place already. These two items alone remove any legitimate claim by Project Northmoor to save the house or land, right? So the whole saving of the house, mm-hmm. not so much, right?
Not necessary.
I think this may be another reason why the Tolkien Society did not endorse their efforts, because they believe it is already protected to the necessary degree. Mm-hmm. My personal view is that the folks of Project Northmoor are using this loose rhetoric of saving Tolkien's home to garner support both financially and through perception by the public. I don't assume to know the hearts and intentions of these people, but to me it seems like they want to turn Tolkien's historic home into a money-making business in the name of Tolkien. Mm. Well, I think there's definitely the marketing question, right? Mm-hmm. You know, how do you market something like this? And in the marketing, my marketing brain is someone who does work in marketing. Is that you don't want the headline to get complicated, right? You know, save Tolkien's home sounds a lot better than, establish on something that's kind of saved already and we don't really need to save it, but we're kind of saving it at the same time in a way. Right. Like,
yeah.
Anyway, it's a good point though, Jonathan.
Yeah. And it appeals to the emotional
absolutely.
Aspect.
Well, that's
of
what
it
you
too.
Want, you know, that's
yeah.
what you want a good headline
absolutely.
To do, right?
Yeah.
it's the whole question, the eternal question of like, being kind of stricter about the truth and, wanting clicks, right? Mm. Like wanting people to click on something, it's a challenge. It's something
it's
that people
balance.
Wrestle with in these, mm-hmm. in these sorts of things.
Yeah.
This, he says, he goes on to say, this to me is unacceptable. If they wanted to purchase the home and land to further protect it to remain exactly the way it was when Tolkien lived there, restoring it to its original design, if any of that has changed, that would be one thing. Wanting to make it alterations to it so it can be used as a bed and breakfast is unacceptable. As someone who works with hundreds of thousands of historically valuable specimens, we don't alter them to make money for the museum. We study them, research them, and then share our findings to promote financial donations to continue research that folks are interested in. I concede that Project Northmoor does not claim to be both museum or similar organization. To me, though, that is the only worthy organization of owning a property like this. A museum, a land trust, or conservation trust, these types of organizations exist to protect historical places of value. Jonathan, right now you sound to me like Indiana Jones and The Last Crusade. It belongs in a museum, right? I know you haven't seen that one, but or it's been a long time since you have.
Yeah, it's been a minute.
I've been trying to get the fam to watch to watch that one. But
we did watch one of them.
Watch Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Yeah, you sound like Indiana Jones to me right now, which is cool. this thing belongs in a museum, right? Perhaps I'm off my rocker here, and others believe that what Project Northmoor is intending to do is perfectly legitimate. I welcome their thoughts and discussion of it on it, but as of right now, as I read the situation, it doesn't surprise me at all that the Tolkien Society passed on this. Their goal is to preserve Tolkien's name, and by offering up his home to an organization that has been around for 1 month and has a two-page plan, well, let's just say if someone came to the museum with that, they wouldn't get a second meeting, and we deal with buildings of similar historical value, such as Frank Lloyd Wright's architectural buildings. At the end of the day, we can speculate what the folks at Project Northmoor intend to do with the home and property, but I don't even get that far when I realize that both the home and property are already under protection from the historical registry and conservation easement. That's enough to remove Project Northmoor's claim of saving the property. Mm-hmm. Goodness, that was a lot, he says. I digress and would love to hear both of your thoughts and any other listeners' views on my thoughts listed above. Keep on keeping on. Your bird nerd friend, John. Bird nerd friend. So, amazing email, mm-hmm. Jonathan. Fantastic thoughts. And I mean, I think you probably nailed it. You know, I don't disrespect what Project Northmore is trying to do in essence. Like, I think what they're trying to do in terms of establishing if somebody wants to establish a literary center, a creative writing center, you know, kind of based on Tolkien and other inklings, that's great, right? You know, more power to you. But yeah, it may not like it once you get into that side of things where it's like, well, we're doing this in the name of preserving something. I can see why people were suspicious and cautious about going over into the realm of like, is this going to be kind of a for-profit thing? Is this going to be like, you know, making modifications? You're making a bed and breakfast out of this place. Are we going to get the full, it's starting to sound maybe a little bit like it's kind of an amusement park, right? Let's come get the full Tolkien experience, right? Stay at the bed and breakfast. You know, it's like, there's just something that's different from the museum approach, right? From the, let's preserve things in the name of history, in the name of preserving the knowledge of human history. There's a difference between those two things. And I think I do think it's important that a division, you know, exists between them, right?
Yeah.
Otherwise, every museum turns into a, you know, an amusement park, or Ripley, you know, Ripley's Believe It or Not, or, you know, something like that. So,
yeah.
I think it's a similar question to kind of like with the national parks. Yes, you can go to places where, like, you know, they're really nice, like resorts, and nature is kind of, you know, these beautiful places have been developed to some degree. Obviously that happens too much in some places. Some places you can do it pretty well. And, you know, it's like, in my mind, like mm-hmm. it's commercially, like people are realizing more and more over the years that it's commercially smart to actually like respect the places, even if you're going to build like a big resort or something like that, mm-hmm. protect the place, mm-hmm. you know, that you have this land on, and don't be so like crass about developing it. Right.
Right.
But at the end, that's why I'm a huge fan of the national parks themselves. Mm-hmm. Right. Like, cause I look at all these beautiful places and I just wonder if the National Parks Service hadn't been put in place, you know, in the late 19th century, you know, what would have happened to a place like the Grand Canyon by now? What would have happened to all these beautiful places that we went a few years ago in Utah, right? In Southern Utah, right? It's just, the natural beauty is incredible, and you love being able to just go to those places and anybody be able to just kind of behold mm-hmm. them as they are, mm-hmm. right?
Mm-hmm. The Grand Canyon, I feel like, is starting to become a little bit overdeveloped.
Grand Canyon was felt a little bit Disney World-ish, but just because, I mean, it's there's a lot of people there. That's really the big thing.
And they do have I mean, there was building a lot too, but
trust me, compare it to actual Disney World or an actual amusement park.
I've never been.
You've been to an amusement park.
Oh, I have.
Compare it to one of those, and it's still very underdeveloped.
It is. That's true. Yeah. That is true. Yeah, but it probably is the most, you know, popular, or maybe the most popular vacation destination among the national parks.
Yeah.
So it makes sense that they would want to have, you know, places for people to stay.
Absolutely.
Because there's really not many other places around, like, close that you can stay unless you stay in the park. Anyway,
yeah,
rabbit trail. Sorry, yeah. But yeah, no, I totally agree with everything that Jonathan said there.
Absolutely, it's great stuff, Jonathan. And sorry, it's taken us so long to get to these notes. You know, you write something like that, and I'm like, my heart's like, well, I don't want to just like kind of deal with this amongst the rest of everything else.
Right.
This is too thoughtful, and you know, you obviously put a lot of time and thought into writing both of these emails. So thanks for your correspondence,
yes,
and figure out how to get the bird, you know, how to deal with your bird email. I think
we need an episode.
I think we need an episode, and I think we, you know, hope maybe we can get Jonathan on to discuss it.
That
would
be awesome.
Yeah.
That would be so awesome. Birds are fascinating.
Birds are fascinating, mm-hmm. and they're kind of a important role in Middle Earth.
They really, you know? They're huge. I mean, obviously the eagles,
right,
are kind of the one that jumps to mind. But then there's so many other.
I just think like the gulls, like
yeah, the gulls,
you know,
yeah, for the, yeah, that's on the seashore.
Yeah.
Or yeah, I know there's so many and tons more.
So much thanks to you, our bird nerd friend.
Mm-hmm. Yes, thank you.
All right, and the other topic we're gonna actually a couple of notes from YouTube. The first is just a shorter note from longtime listener Tom M. this is in response to our last episode posted over on YouTube, episode 243. He says, it's 2:30 on a Friday before Memorial Day weekend. I'm with Greta on this one. My head hurts. Mornings might be better for my listening. Have a great weekend. Thanks for the interesting content and vocabulary lesson. And I responded, that old butter scraped over too much bread feeling? He said, yes. I definitely have blood sugar issues in the afternoon. So,
my friend.
Yes.
We can relate to one another.
Yeah, Greta can relate.
Yes.
Great to hear from you, Tom.
Mm-hmm, yes.
And then another note on that same episode from Timothy D., left on June 2nd. And this is for that whole Notion Club clarification. And I want to say Marilyn also sent us a note that I just got right before we recorded on this same issue. And so that's a preface to what Timothy here says. Please clarify, were the Notion Club papers rediscovered in 2012 in real life or in the fictional frame narrative? If it's real life, I understand Greta's astonishment since Professor Tolkien had been dead for 39 years. However, I'm pretty sure that John is trying to say that the rediscovery occurred in the fictional frame narrative, in which case it seems that John and Greta might have miscommunicated.
Hmm.
So you remember getting tripped up on
this
last time?
Yes, I was very tripped up on that.
Yeah, so I responded. I said, Sauron Defeated, in which the story fragment the Notion Club papers is contained, was published in 1992. The Notion Club papers is a narrative where mysterious records of the Notion Club are discovered in the fictional year 2012, which for Tolkien at the time was the far distant future. The Notion Club papers were definitely around long before the real 2012, since Tolkien wrote the narrative in the mid-1940s. All the story nesting and framing makes for very confusing explaining, so thanks for asking. I tried to do my best on the episode, so hopefully this puts to rest any further ambiguity. So,
I feel like such a dork. Yeah. Okay, if you had just said the fictional year 2012, like that would have cleared it totally up for me. But I was thinking of like 2012, like literally, like someone was just in a classroom in 2012 and was like, oh my gosh, papers from Professor Tolkien. Okay. Yeah.
Well, here's what I woke up to this morning from Marilyn on this subject. Hello, Carswells. First off, I enjoyed your naming of Tolkien as meta. It seems he was meta before the idea of meta ever entered our contemporary cultural conversation. I think he was.
Boom.
He was out of his
yes.
time. As for Notion Club papers, it's really important to remember that this is fiction. No one ever discovered this manuscript in 2012. That was part of the frame narrative that Tolkien created for it. The characters in the Notion Club papers are said to be composites of the various Inkling members. Their names, interests, and characteristics are randomly mixed and scattered amongst these new fictional folks. In effect, the frame is an imaginary alternative version of how the Inkling meetings ran. And into that frame comes the tale of the founding of Numenor, remembered through dreams by two of the members of the Notion Club. So not all the members have these dreams, and some of them openly disbelieve them. They are tied into a language which is related to Andunayak, the language of Numenor. Tolkien wrote the text in the midst of his first drafting of Lord of the Rings, which he was stuck in transition between sections. Laudum and Jeremy turn out to be oh so distantly related to Elendil and Voronwë of Numenor, and they have flashbacks to the drowning of Numenor which are overlaid onto their 20th century surroundings in Oxford and elsewhere. This is Tolkien's time travel story, as you mentioned, but the mechanism for the time travel is dreams, and the focus is on how ancient memories become the myths and legends of the descendants of those who were the original witnesses of the experiences remembered. I'm pretty sure that's accurate. It sounds right to me. Mm-hmm. The Notion Club papers is a remarkably convoluted text, but it's interesting as a major part of Tolkien's development of the story of Numenor, which he eventually incorporated into Lord of the Rings through Aragorn's lineage and inheritance. Definitely worth a deeper look, but it takes a lot of rereading to sort it all out.
Mm.
So
that's very kind of Marilyn
yeah.
to give us give us kind of an excuse there for our or for my confusion. It does take a lot of sorting out.
Oh, it does. I mean, obviously you weren't the only one who was confused by it.
Yeah.
And so
I'm
glad.
It's so much clearer to me now, though.
Good. Right.
So thank you, guys.
Just 2012 in the Notion Club papers is a fictional year. Right.
I don't believe you ever said that when we were talking.
I'm sorry.
But I don't. I for some reason didn't connect the dots between time travel and 2012. Like mm-hmm. Anyway.
Yeah.
My brain wasn't working quite right, I guess. But
no, I guess I didn't do a great job of explaining it. So
maybe that you should have mansplained a little more, John. Maybe I could have used it.
She just told me to mansplain.
I'm just saying.
Look, I got told to mansplain. All right.
Well, I'm not saying that it's always, out of place, but good that was very complicated.
Yeah.
So, well, between you and Marilyn, you You cleared it up for me, and I appreciate that.
Right on.
Yeah, thank
right
you.
Right on.
Thank you.
Great correspondence this week, y'all. And it's always so great to hear from everybody. We'd love to hear from each and every one of you. TolkienRoadPodcast@gmail.com, TolkienRoad.com, Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, etc. All right. On our next episode, it is Volume 11, which is The War of the Jewels. So we're getting to the end of our History of Middle-Earth miniseries.
Is that the last one, the 11th, or is there are there 12?
There are 12.
Okay.
There are 12. So the 12th is entitled The Peoples of Middle-Earth.
Oh.
So.
Okay.
Yeah, and then there's an index, but we're not going to do an episode on the index. We'll probably do an episode kind of recapping the entire series and maybe looking back at the things that we're most interested in looking at again.
Okay.
So
okay.
That's what I'm thinking at this point. But I'm also excited to get beyond it and move on further down the road and some other ideas that I've got. And don't forget, you got your Kalabaith reread coming up.
Can you remind me of my deadline for that, please?
Right now it's early July, so you probably need to have it done by end of June.
You mean early July? Oh, you said early July.
Yeah,
you're saying early June. I'm like, yeah. It is early June. Okay.
Yeah.
So I need to have it done by end of June.
That's what I'm thinking.
Because early July, and I'm rereading A Kalabaith. Okay.
Yeah.
Got it.
All right, that's all for this episode. Thanks to our amazing patrons, especially the following: Caitlin of Tea with Tolkien,
Lee Sue,
Andrew T,
John R,
Ms. Anonymous,
Shannon S,
Brian O,
Emilio P,
Zeke F,
James A,
James L,
Chris L,
Chuck F,
Azia V,
Ish of the Hammer,
Teresa C,
David of Pints with Jack,
Jonathan D,
Eric S,
Joey S,
Eric B,
Johanna T,
Mike M,
Du Renayer,
Robert H,
Paul D,
Jacob S,
and Julia.
As well as those celebrating their patron anniversary in June, Teresa C.
and James L.
Thank you so much, guys.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you to everyone for listening. We will talk at you next time.
Bye, y'all.
Bye-bye.